I call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2019, and the time is 1:30.
There's too much red meat in this.
First on the agenda is HB 41, Shellfish Enhancement Projects Hatcheries, and we have a CS for that. And can I get a motion, Representative Johnston? And just before you do that, maybe I'll call the roll so they know everybody's here. Been a nice weekend. Welcome back, everybody. And with us today, Representative Knopf, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sylvan Leonard, and Representative Ortiz. I'm Representative Wilson and Co-Chair Foster. And we have a full committee today. And with that, Representative Johnston.
I move committee substitute for HB 4131-LS0218 version U as the working document.
Seeing no objection, I call Ms. Gaddis up to the table, please, to go over the changes in committee substitute for House Bill 41. And then we will get comments from the bill sponsor, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lynn Gaddis, staff for Representative Wilson. And with that, it looks like everybody's ready to go. I'll go over the CS. CS 31-LS0218/U, or the U version. If you'll note on page 1, line 3, back up, page 1, line 2, after projects, we're inserting authorizing the Department of Fish and Game to collect fee revenue from applicants for certain salmon hatchery permits and from applicants for shellfish enhancement project permits. The next change is on page 2, section 15. At the end of the sentence, it starts in the section 16, amount determined under H of this section, so it strikes out 1,000.
That would be section 2, lines 15 and 16.
That's correct. I apologize. And everybody's there, and I'll start again. Section 2, lines 15, in the amount of determined under H, striking out 1,000, this section. Section 3, line 19 on page 2, inserts AS16.10.400 and amended by adding the new subsection to read, the department shall establish by regulation an application fee under this section in the amount that provides for the total amount of fees collected under B of this section to approximately equal the department's actual regulatory costs under this chapter. The department shall annually review the fee level to determine whether the department's regulatory costs under the chapter are approximately equal to the fees collected. If the review indicates that the fee collections and regulatory costs are not approximately equal, the department shall adjust the application fee by regulation in January of each year. The department shall report the fee level and any revision made for the previous year under the subsection of the Office of Management and Budget. Line item 29I, the salmon hatchery permit fees collected under B of this section shall be deposited in the State Treasury under AS37.05.146C. The fees shall be accounted for separately and appropriations from the account are not made from the unrestricted. Moving to page 3, line 1, general fund. The legislature may appropriate money from the account for expenditures by the department for necessary costs incurred by the department in the administration of this chapter. Nothing in this subsection creates a dedicated fund or dedicates the money in the account for a specific purpose. Money deposited in the account does not lapse at the end of a fiscal year unless otherwise provided by an appropriation. Section 4, item 5, excuse me, line item 14, strikes out 1,000 and puts in the amount determined under F of this section. Page 3, Chapter 12, item, excuse me, line item 25, adds the department shall establish by regulation application fee under the section in amount that provides for the total fees collected under B of this section to approximately equal the department's actual regulatory costs under this chapter. The department shall annually review the fee level to determine whether the department's regulatory costs under the chapter are approximately equal to the fees collected. If the review indicates that fee collection and regulatory costs are not approximately equal, the department shall adjust the application fee by regulation in, page 4, line item 1, January of each year. The department shall report the fee level on any revision made for the previous year under this subsection to the office management and budget. Page 4, line item 3G, the shellfish enhancement project permit fees collected under B of this section shall be deposited in the state treasury under AS 37.05.146C. The fees shall be accounted for separately, and appropriations from the account are not made from the unrestricted general fund. The legislature may appropriate money from the account for expenditures by the department for necessary costs incurred by the department in the administration of this chapter. Nothing in this subsection creates a dedicated fund or dedicates the money in the account for a specific purpose. Money deposited in the account does not lapse at the end of a fiscal year unless otherwise provided by an appropriations. And next we move to page 10, item, line item 2, and quite frankly, it's just a spelling error. It takes semi, space, artificial, and turns it into one word, semi-artificial.
Thank you. And what this does is that we're hoping that this program grows. So this would allow that whatever is necessary for the program that the department can charge it back to these groups, but the money is only to be utilized by these groups on it. What the other thing we're trying to make sure it doesn't happen is, for instance, they had to change the fees from $100 all of a sudden to $1,000, which is a lot of money. This would allow the department to set the fees based on, just like we do for our boards and commissions, based on the resources that are necessary to keep these programs going. Any questions? Representative Ortiz, would you like to add anything?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so we are waiting on the fiscal note. We need to put forward the working documents so that we could get a fiscal note. Hopefully we will have those by tomorrow, and would be my intent, if the will of the committee, to move this along its way tomorrow as soon as we have the fiscal note. Seeing no further questions or concerns, we're going to set HB 41 aside, awaiting its fiscal note. Next, we're going to be taking up HB 87.
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for HB 87, 31-LS06119, version M, as the working document.
Thank you very much. Any objection? Seeing no objection, the working document is before us. I again call Ms. Gaddis to the table to explain the changes in HB 87. And then we'll have the bill sponsor up to weigh in on these changes as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the committee, my name is Lynn Gaddis, staff for Representative Wilson. On page 1, line 6, the CS deletes June 30th, 2021 and adds back January 1, 2020. There's a new section C, that would commence commercial operation between January 2nd, 2020 to January 30th, 2021, may apply a refundable credit against a tax liability that may be imposed on the person under this chapter or receive the amount of credit in the form of a payment for the taxable year in which the liquefied natural gas storage facility commences commercial operation. The tax credit or payment under this section may not exceed the lesser of $7,500,000, or 50% of the cost incurred to establish or expand the liquefied natural gas storage facility.
Representative Knopp.
Madam Chair, I need to back up to page 1, line 7. You might reread that to me or be clear, because I thought you said what it did to the dates. It's just contrary to what it reflects.
So, Madam Chair, it was page 1, line 6, and it deletes June 30th, 2021, and adds back in January 1st, 2020.
And what work draft are you on? What version are you on? M?
M.
In the M version?
Yes, version M.
And so it is line 7.
So what we're doing in this committee substitute is that the original was asking for an extension of the $15 million in tax credits. What we have done is that it's our understanding, we also have Mr. Britton on the line, that they will be able to take care of the Fairbanks storage tank by the original date, which was January 1st, 2020. And then they would only need the extension for the other storage, which would only be 7.5 amount. So I'm going to take it at ease for a minute, because I've got a lot of questions on people's faces.
Yeah.
Back on the record, and there is a typo on this one, so we are going to set this one aside and get the right version. So there'll be a new one that will come to us tomorrow to have the right dates on that. And I'm sorry for the inconvenience, but we will have this back before us tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So with that, do we have someone here for the next bill, House Bill 114? Well, come put yourself on the record. We're going to take it at ease. On the record, and sorry about that. So the June 30th, 2021 is correct on page 1. What that is that we are extending the program, but we're extending the program in a different fashion. And if you turn then to page 2, it will now then explain that there's now going to be two parts to this. You will have where you have to be by the end of the year, you would have to complete and commercialize to receive the $15 million. And then come January 1st is when you would have 50% up to $7.5 million on another gas storage tank. Representative Thompson.
Hi, my name is Steve Thompson. I represent District 2 in Fairbanks. And Madam Chair, thank you for bringing this back up and for the CS. I am not opposed to the CS at all. I believe that you have online the general manager of the Interior Gas Utility, and if there's any questions of them about this CS.
Mr. Britton, can you put yourself on the record and respond to whether or not you believe that you're going to be able to have the commercialization done on the original tank that you currently have?
Hello, were you speaking with me?
Can you try that again?
Hi, this is Dan Britton. You faded out a little. I couldn't quite hear if you were requesting information of me.
Yes, we are. So what this CS would do is that before January 1st, 2020, as on page 2, this is the original program, so we're not changing the original program on the $15 million or 50% of the cost incurred or established to establish or expand the liquefied natural gas storage facility. The second part on line 7 is new on or after January 1st, 2020 and before January 30th, 2021. May not exceed the lesser $7.5 million or 50% of the cost incurred or established or expanded the liquefied natural gas storage facility. Our question is, do you think you can meet those deadlines?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you. It is our full intention to be able to meet those deadlines, particularly with the large storage project. We continue to be on schedule and anticipate that facility will be in operation prior to the existing January 1st, 2020 deadline. The facilities in North Pole are the schedule continues to advance. However, we will likely not have that done by the end of 2019, and therefore the extension that's contemplated in the CS helps out to that regard. So we feel we can work within the committee substitute that has been provided, and thank you.
And you do also understand that this is going to come out of the oil and gas fund, so you will be in line with all those other companies that are waiting for those funds to become available.
We do understand that that is the funding mechanism.
Right. There is no unrestricted general funds that are going to this project. I also want to make it clear, although this is was brought to us by the Interior Gas Utility, if someone else does have a gas storage tank that fits underneath this statute and could come online within these dates, they would be eligible for this. So this is not, I don't know of any others, but I just want to make sure everybody understands that this does not work for just the interior. But if there was another community looking to do something like this, they would have to commercialize underneath the $7.5 million before January 30th, 2021, and also wait for the oil and gas fund to have money in it to be able to have those credits paid for or bought off by another company that's making a profit in the state of Alaska. Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just for my own clarification and for the public's clarification, the impact of this bill is to, in a limited scope, extend the tax credit program. And is it only this bill, is there any other potential other than tank storage, is there any other potential projects out there that could maybe use this bill to get their own credits applied?
No, Representative Ortiz, this is very specific. It's only for gas storage tanks.
Okay.
So there would have to be a gas storage tank.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Knopp.
I guess, well, since we have the maker of the bill here, I want to, Madam Chair, thank you. I want to be clear that, so under the original version A, we were extending the deadline from January 1, 2020 to June 30th, 2021. This version actually shortens it by 6 months to January 2021. That is our intent. Chair.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Knopp, that's correct. The Interior Gas Utility feels that they should be able to meet this deadline very easily, and it also puts some sideboards on that we're not extending the $15 million possible total credit, but it's limiting it to the $7,500,000.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious. I'm good with limiting the reimbursement rate there. I'm a little concerned that January, June, why are we going back 6 months and not allowing them that grace? Why did we not just leave it at the original version of June? Cutting them back six more months puts us in a predicament if they don't make it to in fact have to go through this process again. You know,
Representative Knopf, it's an incentive. It's an incentive to get your acting gear and get it moving.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good way to put it.
Fair enough. Thank you.
You know, and we're really trying to get these types of tax credits, you know, off the books, but at the same time realizing that there's still high cost of energy in many parts of our state that hopefully won't have that issue for much longer. And again, we want to make sure, too, that there is a fund that it will be coming out of, but it probably won't be being paid out very soon, because literally there are others that have already done what they need to for these tax credits, and they're in line first. Any other questions? Yep. Representative Knopf. Should stop when
so,
I was ahead.
And I'm going to apologize to the maker because I didn't get to scrutinize this thing really thoroughly, but I also saw, is this a change where we talk about reimbursements based on a tax liability? Are they actually cash credits? I thought I read something in there that says it's to be applied towards a future tax liability. And my understanding is these were nonprofits and probably would not have a tax liability.
So this is the original language, and these are part of the cashable tax credits. And you're right, this is a nonprofit. They'll have to wait for the funding to come back, but they can also sell their tax credits to someone who is making a profit. There's different options of being able to get these paid out. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Knopf, these are a cashable tax credit.
Okay, we'll take a look at it.
And they are not undesignated general funds.
Any other questions? Again, same thing. We're going to set this bill aside. Hopefully, we'll have the fiscal note in the morning because now they have the committee substitute, and we hope to see you back here at 9 a.m.
Thank you.
And my apologies, Representative Sponholz. Thank you. If you'd like to come to the table with anyone you'd like to have join you, put yourself on the record. You may begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. I am Representative Ivy Sponholz, sitting at a very low chair here, and with me is my aide, Bernice Nesbitt, who is carrying this bill. We're here today to talk about HB 114, which is the Sharp 3 bill. Healthcare is one of Alaska's largest and most dynamic industries, and yet for many Alaskans, especially in rural areas, they continue to have challenges in accessing to care. One of the major reasons for this, particularly in rural Alaska, is due to a shortage of healthcare providers. It's hard to recruit and retain healthcare professionals in rural Alaska. They have large amounts of student debt combined with really high cost of living in rural Alaska, results in a lot of financial pressures. So HB 114 seeks to address this issue by establishing the Healthcare Professionals Workforce Enhancement Program, which is more commonly known as SHARP 3. In which healthcare professionals agree to work for a provider for a minimum of 3 years in exchange for a loan repayment for student loans or direct incentives. Employers can use this program for up to 4 times with an individual healthcare practitioner for a total of 12 years. Employers will fully fund this program, taking advantage of a federal tax exemption available only to a state-run program. We looked at alternatives to this. Could this go to the Community Foundation? Could it go elsewhere? No, it has to run through the state of Alaska in order for this program to continue to be tax sheltered. The success of the healthcare loan repayment incentive programs in increasing healthcare workforce in Alaska has been demonstrated. The Department of Health and Social Services' existing state loan repayment incentive program, SHARP 2, which was a combination of private funding and state funding, is scheduled to sunset on June 30th of 2019 this year. So this is a time-sensitive issue. We need to get it done. Between 2013 and 2015, SHARP 2 was successful in recruiting or retaining 83 clinicians statewide, with a majority of the clinicians placed in off-road system, emphasizing care for rural and underserved populations. The program is also used for underserved populations, for example, that are Medicaid eligible as well. So Anchorage Neighborhood Health, Fairbanks Community Health are also eligible to use this program, just to clarify. This program builds on the success of SHARP 2, introducing new practices, new occupations, new employers, new locations and roles, but it will be entirely privately funded. That's the Cliff Notes.
Any questions for the sponsor? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sponholz, because SHARP 2 has been in effect, with the extension or with the addition of SHARP 3, do we see an increasing problem, even though Sharp 2 has been in practice. Is the problem a growing problem? So in other words, did Sharp 2 effectively address the issue of the need for healthcare professionals throughout all of Alaska effectively, or is it a growing problem?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I would say that Sharp 2 has been effective, but our workforce shortage continues to grow. We're more aware now of behavioral health care issues than we ever have been in Alaska. I think everybody's aware we have an opioid problem. Alcohol continues to be the number one drug of choice for Alaskans. We have a mental health, care gap in the state of Alaska. So I would say it's been effective in helping to address some of our health care shortage needs, but we now know, that we have behavioral health care challenges we weren't even really aware of 10 years ago. So the program continues to be very important, I think. In this version of the bill, we have added in additional mental health providers for eligibility, for example, which I think is an important update to the SHARP program. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? And did you have any presentation or other information you'd like to give us?
We do have a short presentation.
So for the record, Bernice Nisbet, staff to Representative Sponholz, we actually have someone for the department to do the historical presentation for HB 114. But I am here to do the sectional analysis.
Okay. Whoever you want, please invite them up. Okay. And I also want to bring up, we probably won't do the sectional analysis. We have the companion bill coming our way this week. Actually, should have been voted on today. And so we will be working with Representative Sponholz on the Senate bill. And that will be before us this week. And then we'll go through the sectional analysis, as I know there are some differences between both bills. But we're going to go ahead and go through the presentation so we can understand the purpose and what we hope to gain.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jill Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for the Alaska Division of Public Health. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. And I'm very pleased to be able to be here and hopefully answer your questions about how this program works. HB 114 does a couple of things. It establishes a healthcare professionals workforce enhancement program. We have nicknamed that as SHARP 3 because we already have a SHARP 1 and a SHARP 2 program. It addresses the shortage of healthcare workers that we have across the state. The program's basic component is that a healthcare professional agrees to work for 3 years in underserved areas in exchange for repayment of either a student loan debt or a direct incentive. The employers will fully fund this particular program, and there are no unrestricted general funds involved in this SHARP 3. As you heard, it is replacing the existing program that we have called SHARP 2, which sunsets June 30th of this year.
We have a question from Representative Tilton.
Thank you. Hi, Jill. Thanks for being here today. My question is just, can you help me to understand and define underserved areas?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Tilton. Underserved areas really target what type of population you're serving. So it is uninsured, those who receive Medicaid, Medicare, or other public types of health coverage, Indian Health Services, the VA. There's also a term called health shortage area, which really has more to do with the geography and the type of employer and the type of specialties that we're looking at.
Thank you. I appreciate that because I was considering whether it was the geographic was underserved or now. So health shortage is more the geographic, and population underserved population is different types, would you say?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, that's correct. Underserved really talks more about the populations that are being served. And the health shortage area is more about the specialties and where they are located in the state.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Knopf.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll ask for your forgiveness because this is way over my head. I know nothing about this. But I heard you say that this is 100% funded by employers. Did I hear that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, that is correct. In SHARP 3, we no longer are using any state general funds. The employers will fully fund the program, not only the benefit that goes to the employees, but also the cost to run the program. And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow?
So on that note, before we get off that topic, then, is it going to be mandatory for employers to participate? So, and if it is it more of a disincentive for them? Or is it going to reduce, is it going to be, here's what I see. If it's a mandatory participation for employers, they may be reluctant to pay as much as they normally would. So you could see some reduced payroll, or maybe reluctant to hire somebody with that particular debt they'd have to participate in. So I just want to know if that's been discussed.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, this is not a mandatory program. This is entirely voluntary. The employers decide whether or not they would like to participate in this program, and they apply for to make sure that they are eligible where they are in a health shortage area and serve the underserved, as well as the employee is not required to participate either, so this is voluntary on all levels. And they are precluded in the contract from reducing an employee's pay in order to receive this benefit. They cannot essentially penalize that employee for that. This is on top of.
Thank you.
Representative Bonhoes, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, thank you. I just want to add that there's a SHARP council that is comprised of employers. We have a representative of the SHARP council here today that it was actually employers and providers in the community that helped sort of conceive of SHARP 3 as it is today. So this is not us telling the employer community how to do something. They actually came to us and said, this is how we would like to do this moving forward in light of the fact that we have a fiscal gap and we won't be able to identify state funding for it. We want to be a part of the solution, which I think is a great sign.
And Representative Bonhoes, feel free to stay at the table and chime in whenever you would like. Ms. Lewis.
As Representative Bonhoes already talked a little bit about some of the challenges in healthcare access and how this bill addresses them, not only do we have a shortage, but we also have a maldistribution of those professionals across the state to where we don't necessarily have all the right types of providers in all the right places. And so this bill also will help address that. Certainly we know that healthcare sites struggle with recruiting and retaining the healthcare professionals that they have, and it's quite costly for them to do the recruitments. And the health professionals also have challenges with large student debt, and this bill will help with both of those.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question, if I could, please. We're talking about healthcare professionals from across the state in various rural areas. What are some of the pronounced professions then that we're looking at with regard to a shortage? Used to be radiologists that were incredibly in demand. Is it general practitioners as well as physical therapists, occupational therapists? You know, what's the largest demand, if you will?
Through the chair to Representative Sullivan Leonard, I would have to say that we have shortages in, depending on where you're looking in the state, in pretty much every occupation, from primary care to specialists to people who work in hospitals to surgeons to every kind of provider. And that's why this bill not only has this list of a dozen or so occupations that is specifically targeting, but there is another option, a third tier, that allows us to add in other occupations, because we can't anticipate all of the demand and where it will be, and it changes over time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell from the previous program, what is the success rate in filling hard-to-fill positions? I'm talking about in the more rural areas that are harder to fill.
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, the SHARP 2 program operated for just a few years. We actually had to stop this a couple of years early because we no longer had the undesignated general funds to apply to the program. And so We had 83 participants. All those contracts have been completed. About half of those were in very hard to fill positions. Very hard to fill takes into account how long the position has been vacant and how difficult the recruitment has been. As evidence, the employer provides us evidence of how they have recruited for the position. So about half of these were very hard to fill. Retention has been pretty good on the positions. Most of the folks who have participated indicate that on average they are looking at 8 years of staying with their provider, the employer that they have, and about 14 years in state. So, and that's for a 3-year commitment that they made. So they are on average indicating that they will stay much longer once they've completed their contract.
May continue?
Thank you. So if I could for a few minutes, just for a minute or two, like to tell you a little bit about the current program, Shark 2, that this program is replacing. As I said, it operated for a few years from 2013 through 2018, but no new contracts after 2015. In that time, when it was most active, 2013 to 15, we had 83 contracts. All of those contracts were completed and fully paid out. About half, as I said, were very hard to fill. We're going to talk about the difference in the tiers in another slide just coming up, but there are two tiers in Sharp 2, and there will be three tiers in our new Sharp 3. The average payment was a little over $25,000 a year across all of the tiers, and employers for Sharp 2 provided 10 to 30% of the match. In the new program, they will provide 100% of the funding. It was broad-based with 83 contracts. We had 31 employers who participated, nonprofit, hospitals, tribal, non-tribal. You can see that there was participation across the state, and it sort of depends on who was interested in participating because it's voluntary. As to whether or not we had a lot of applicants in those particular areas.
And could you tell me why you believe that the Interior Northern Region only 3% went there? Is there a reason why they didn't participate at the same level as the others?
To the chair, I don't know the particular reasons, but I think that it has to do with how many applied, how many employers applied to participate in that area.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the chair. How many of these employers are nonprofits and how many are they for-profit?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, a majority were nonprofit, but certainly for-profit entities are allowed to participate as well. I think we actually have that number in the in your package. You may have a report, a final report on the Sharp 2 program. And if I may take a moment to see where that is. Report has a lot of tables. I'm flipping through to see which table would best answer your question.
Excuse me, through the chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
While you're looking for that, the reason I ask is the benefits of doing this through the state program versus community foundation, whatever, is that it allows for federal income tax, and it, you know, as far as repayment from the federal income tax. So I'm concerned, I'm wondering if that's a cash credit that could go to nonprofits versus, you know, for profit. So that's my follow up.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't have to look for a table to explain that part. Mm-hmm. Yeah. the tax incentive is to the employee. It is their individual income tax. This is if you have a student loan repayment, and it is done through a state-run program. If that state-run program targets the underserved and health shortage areas, all of the above, then it is exempt from them as income. If they get a direct incentive, it is taxable. For the employer, the benefit is that generally they end up paying more if they were to do this on their own, because they would be trying to hold that employee harmless for the tax. And so they would end up paying out a greater amount of money in order to do that. So it tends to cost them a little less to participate in this program.
Thank you for the clarification.
And also, of the 83 total contracts, 82% were with nonprofits, 16% were with government entities, while another 2% were with for-profit agencies. Page 13 for anybody who wants to check my reading.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
You may continue.
So this SHARP 3 program is an innovative solution. It's a public-private partnership. It will build on the success of both SHARP 1 and SHARP 2, but it expands on those. Both of those programs are limited in the types of positions that they can fund and also the different types of employers and the geographic areas they can serve. SHARP 3 allows a lot more flexibility and will respond to the demand of the industry as to where the shortages are, in what occupations, and over time can be much more flexible. As Representative Sponholt said, 10 years ago, we did not know how much of a demand there was, and there wasn't as high a demand for behavioral health positions as there are today. So this SHARP 3 allows us a lot more flexibility. SHARP 1 and 2 also, while they have allowed some urban areas to participate, they really target primary care and rural areas. And that has actually been difficult for some of the larger urban areas who would really like to participate. And this bill lifts that restriction as long as they still are having a shortage and they're still doing serving an underserved population.
And primarily the underserved, this is Representative Sponholt, primarily the underserved population would be the uninsured population. You know, so we're talking about people that are on Medicaid and who don't have their own health insurance, so they need access to care. So we're talking primarily about organizations in urban Alaska, for example, like Anchorage Neighborhood Health or Fairbanks, you know, Community Health Center. So
thank you.
Another thing that makes this a little bit different, in the programs that we have, they kind of break down the types of occupations into three major categories: medical, dental, and behavioral health. And in the other programs, oftentimes you can have an area where it will have a shortage in dental, but not in medical or behavioral health. And so you don't get to apply the incentive to all the types of occupations you might like to. And this bill will effectively open that up to more areas. So there's a number of benefits that this bill will bring. Healthcare sites will be able to hire much needed staff that they struggle with. The professionals, they get assistance with their student loan debt. Alaskans will have improved access to health care because they actually have some providers in rural areas, or if it is more of a hub area that is serving a rural population that comes into them for specialties and things like that, then they will have access to those folks. And that we all know that access to healthcare is important for maintaining good health, which then reduces costs to healthcare in general. And we are able to do all of this without any use of undesignated general funds this time.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, for Ms. Lewis or Representative Sponholt. So SHARP 2 was covered 10% to 30% by employers, and this will be covered 100% by employers.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how they manage that. And also, if I could be reminded previously, and this is sort of academic, I mean, if they're willing to do it, that's great. But previously, who was covering the other portion under SHARP 2?
The other portion, this is Representative Sponholz, Representative Josephson through the chair. Previously, the state of Alaska was paying for the majority of SHARP 2. SHARP 1 was exclusively a federal program, and so that still exists in a very limited fashion. SHARP 2 was to expand it, was primarily funded by general funds with a complement from private sector funds, and we're saying in SHARP 3 this will be entirely funded by the private sector. We have heard from members of the Sharp Council, and there is one, as I mentioned earlier, who's here to speak on behalf of the council about the program, that the community is prepared to step in and help fund this. But exactly what that will look like will be up to the community, just like, you know, private funding of any program will be. And that could be one of the challenges of the program in the future. I certainly will be watching it very closely to make sure that we're meeting our state's, you know, we're meeting our state's goal of getting, you know, increasing access to health care in the state of Alaska. But the community has said that they're willing to step up and pay more in order to continue to have this program, and the state will help to facilitate that. The private sector providers, I will just mention, they're also paying a fee to administer the program. So we're not actually even spending general fund funds to operate this program moving forward. The idea is that the program would be entirely self-supporting.
Thank you.
So now I would like to shift a little bit and talk about how the new program will operate. Healthcare professionals receive either student loan repayment, or they can receive a direct incentive in exchange for working in underserved areas and health shortage areas. The employer sites provide the healthcare services, and they have to be eligible as well. It's a three-year contractual commitment to work. They can renew up to three more times. That's a total of four rounds and 12 years maximum for a lifetime. This allows for someone who started with one loan maybe to continue their education and to advance as they go, and they can bring another loan in and still participate in the program ongoing. As we've said a couple times, the employer payments will fully cover the cost of both the program payment but also the administrative fee. And we've already mentioned the advisory council a little bit.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lewis, when you talk about, for example, on the first bullet there, with regard to direct incentives for working in the underserved areas, can you give an example of what that direct incentive might be for healthcare professionals?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, direct incentives are something that aren't often chosen. More often, the professionals choose the loans, or they choose a combination of a loan with a direct incentive. The direct incentive is a payment made to the employee. If they receive that, that is considered taxable income to them. The situations where that is really appropriate, and one of the really important reasons for having that included in here, is there are times when you don't necessarily want to have someone maybe brand new out of school. Maybe you want a mid-career professional. You want someone who is more experienced. And we would prioritize, we have been in Sharp 2, prioritizing direct incentives for mid-career professionals for whom they may not have a loan, or they may not have a large loan. And so the direct incentive is a way to still get them into the rural areas.
Follow-up?
So with regard to that, would they also look at other incentives, say, regarding housing or transportation or anything?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the participation in this program does not preclude an employer from offering any other type of incentive. However, this program does limit you that you cannot have a concurrent obligation to for work. You can't have what we call a service obligation at the same time. You can have them sequentially. But if the housing that was offered was also in exchange for them working in a rural area, they could do those as two follow-along contracts, but not at the same time.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've talked about the advisory council, and since they're the ones who do the recommendations for the contract awards, can you just give me an idea of who the council is made up of?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, yes, I can. It is made up of some of the health care clinics and hospitals. It also has a number of professional associations like the Behavioral Health Association or social workers. And it also has some other entities who provide some important information to us. There is the Department of Labor for economic information and on health shortages and employment, the post-secondary education, the Mental Health Trust, and so there's quite a variety. There's about 15 organizations.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering how the advisory council would determine an employer's ability to pay. What are they actually looking at for that? Is it a tie to federal funds or a bank account that's public record, or what? How are we making that determination?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, when an employer decides that they would like to participate, they fill out an application for us, and at that time, they provide information to us on where they are going to get their funds from and help us to determine not only their eligibility but their ability to pay. And for SHARP 2, we have had a waiver process that someone can ask for a waiver of part of their amount. That won't exactly work in SHARP 3 because they're paying 100%, but we still will be looking at a way to do and evaluate their ability to pay and how we're going to move on that going forward.
Follow?
At the very beginning of the brief, I think I heard somebody say something about there were some federal, a way for a federal credit or federal funds to help with this. Could you elaborate on that? Or maybe I'm thinking of something else too, but I think I heard that.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, what you may have heard is that we have another option, which is called SHARP 1, and that is a federal grant. And so those federal funds are available, and that is an option for someone who maybe doesn't have as much money, but it's a much more narrow range of occupations and areas that are available. But certainly we will continue to have that program, and so we will be looking for folks to participate in that.
So a few years ago, I was in Alaska, and they had issues just keeping a provider there. It wasn't even behavioral health. And I remember them saying that as soon as – and I was thinking the program was 3 years, and I could be wrong on how many years it was. But what I do remember is that when they hired someone, then they literally would have to go back out and start looking again because that person normally didn't stay longer than the contractual obligations. So if it was 3 years, and they would then – basically have somebody ready to go back in. Are you seeing the same thing, whether it's, you know, in SHARP 2 or maybe other states in which the individual's not necessarily staying, you know, after their time goes, or is it just totally just dependent upon where it's at?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, we have had pretty good success, we feel, with retaining employees. One of the things that is a little different in the state-run program, ours is for 3 years, and many of the other options that someone might have for this type of support for service type of programs, if they're working with Indian Health Service or if they have the National Health Service Corps or the SHARP 1 option, those are two-year commitments. This is a three-year commitment. And we actually think that that makes a difference because someone has a little longer time to establish themselves in the community, and we think that that has paid off for us. And the participants indicate that they will stay with their employer 8 years in total and 14 in the state, which we feel like is pretty good.
Oh, that's great. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I almost hate to ask these questions because it really shows my ignorance on this issue, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So, if I guess my question would be, what is the state's role in all of this in that sense that an employer could negotiate a deal with an employee to make their student loan payments for 3 years if you stay? And it would be income deferred for the employee, would not show it as income, wouldn't be taxable income to them, but it wouldn't be a benefit to the employer by doing that other than normal deductions. So is there additional incentives to the employer by going this route?
Representative Spahnholz.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf. The incentive for the employer to go through the program is it stretches their dollars further because the employee is not having to pay taxes on it. The net impact using the SHARP program as opposed to providing loan repayment directly to the employee is it stretches further. They don't have to pay taxes on it, so they get more net benefit. So they have to do a little bit of paperwork. They send a check through the state of Alaska, but their dollars stretch further, which means their recruiting and, you know, the recruiting value of those dollars goes further.
And I think that's my question, Madam Chair. Follow-up is the state's role. These checks have to be funneled through the state?
Yeah.
In order for the employer to receive the benefit?
Yes, Representative Knopf. We looked into this. We actually explored whether or not this is something that could be done entirely by the private sector. In my previous career before joining the legislature, I worked in philanthropy, and so my question was, why don't we do this just like we do, you know, a scholarship through the Alaska Community Foundation? And the reason that we do that is that anything that runs through the Community Foundation is treated as taxable income to the employee. And we want to make sure that we are able to stretch these dollars as far as possible to maximize the recruitment value. Running the program through the state shields them from becoming taxable income to the employee and therefore maximizes the value of those dollars.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm putting on my Interior Community Health Center board member hat after 20 years as a board member. What this program would do is would help with recruitment. And yeah, in theory, thinking about this, the employer could build into the compensation package to the provider the benefits of this program. So it could be win-win, very much for the provider to join the health center, and also for the health center to then build into their compensation package the benefit of this program.
Representative LeBlanc, through the chair, I'll just remind you that earlier we said that the SHARP program is designed so that the compensation package in terms of the base compensation has to be the same for somebody participating in the SHARP program or not participating in the SHARP program. SHARP is designed to augment the compensation package by allowing for loan repayment or a direct incentive, but I think there is an incentive for the employer to participate, the healthcare organization to participate, because it helps them to be more effective in their recruiting. If you're talking about retaining employees over a long period of time, the SHARP program has a demonstrated track record of keeping employees at their organizations for 8 years, which is not a standard tenure in healthcare careers these days, where it's a very competitive field. They can basically apply around and get a better package at another place. So if you're able to keep an employee at your organization for 8 years on average, and potentially use the SHARP program for up to 12 years, that's a real incentive to the employer, and the employer will get better, outcomes for their organization because there's value and longevity in an organization.
Representative LeBlanc.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that's true, and I could see the advantage for a provider to accept a proposal from a health center that builds into the package the benefit of the program. Now, if they didn't want the benefit of the program, they're paying directly on their student loans. So I'd say that's a powerful incentive.
Absolutely.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, for Representative Spahnholz, about a minute and a half ago, you said something about how the benefit packages can't be different or something. Can you elaborate on that?
So the base, Representative Josephson, through the chair, the base compensation package has to be the same for participants in the SHARP program. The idea is that you can't offer a lower salary to somebody who's participating in the SHARP program because you're going to offer them loan repayment. You have to offer them the same salary as similar employees. But then on top of that, the SHARP program is designed to be additive on top of your base compensation.
I'm remembering that Ms. Lewis said.
Yeah.
See no further questions, Ms. Lewis. Oh, whoops. See, Representative Carpenter.
Let me ask the question first. Are we going to get into the fiscal note at a later time, or is it appropriate for a question on the fiscal note now?
We're here to learn, whatever you want to ask.
So I understand there's no cost to the state through this, and I'm understanding here that there's an administrative fee. Years 1 through 4 is 5%. Of the contract value, and I'm assuming that's coming out of the money that is coming from the employer. And does that mean for the life of that employee? It says in beginning of year three, one new FTE accounting technician that'll now be on the state books. Is that only for the life of the program, or is that employee now part of the state's employee numbers for perpetuity?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the way that we have envisioned this is our program runs fairly lean. There is a single person who manages this program. At some point, we believe the volume with this sharp three option is going to become too much for one person to manage, and we're going to need someone to help us with collecting the payments and making payments to the lenders, in which that is why we have added in a few years out, when the volume gets large enough, that we've added an accounting technician. If this program was to end, we would no longer need the accounting technician because this is the work that they would be doing. But we are certainly not hoping to end this program. So I would hope the program continues in perpetuity, in which case we would continue to need the accounting tech.
One follow-up. And if the funding source from the employer dries up partway through the contract, does that mean that the contract is then null and void with that employee, or does the state pick up a liability for finishing out the contract?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's an excellent question. The state does not pick up a liability if the employer does not contribute the money that they are supposed to.
Thank you.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just following along with the administrative fee, it says that in year five, you're looking to increase the fee 1.5% to look for a vendor to assist in the administration. Is that to do with the contract collections, or how do you envision that?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, you are correct. Again, we think that as the program matures, we're going to have more work than even the accounting technician can handle. And at that point, rather than continuing to add state employees to take up the volume, we would look for a private vendor who could help us process that. We would keep the accounting technician, however, because someone has to audit that provider, and there still is a fair amount of work that has to go into managing that contract. And so there would still be work for that employee. It would just shift to a little bit different description.
You may continue.
So in Sharp 3, we have three different tiers that address different types of occupations. And we propose that in each of these, there is a different amount of incentive that is paid. Tier 1 and 2 align with what we currently have in terms of amounts in both Sharp 1 and 2. Those are in line with that. Tier 3 is new, and so this is a completely new piece. Tier 1, our dentists, pharmacists, and physicians, $35,000 a year for each of the 3 years. And then if it was a very hard-to-fill position, there is an extra increase and extra incentive on top for that. It works out to 35% on top of the base amount, or in this case, $47,250. Tier 2 includes things like dental hygienists, registered nurses, psychologists, physical therapists, behavioral analysts, social workers. It's a defined list. In Tier 2, they would get $20,000 a year, and again, they'd get a 35% premium if it was a very hard-to-fill position. Tier 3 is for other occupations that are not already eligible under Tier 1 and Tier 2. Those would be for $15,000 a year, and again, there's a very hard-to-fill premium.
And are these tiers actually will be in statute, or will these be able to be changed as time goes by this committee?
Co-Chair Wilson, we're actually going to define define tiers 1, 2, and 3 generally in statute, but allow the board flexibility to make changes over time. One of the things we want to make sure that we can do is that this program can continue to be sort of nimble over time and respond to market forces and not be so rigid that the program itself can't respond without coming back to us for a legal change. That's all right.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yeah. Through the chair, and I'm sorry to take us back where we were on the fiscal note, but at page 7 of the PowerPoint, it refers to the employer paying an administrative fee. That is not a fee that would help cover the accounting tech. Is that right? Or
through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. The administrative fee would cover all the costs to run the program, and that would include in the future the accounting technician. We envision that fee being based on the a percent of the contract's value. And so as each contract comes on or comes off, the amount will change, but we think it will be adequate in order to fund the position. And I think that also might go to Representative Carpenter's question about whether employers were paying this fee in, you know, perpetuity. It's for the duration of the contract they have for the employee-employer relationship for each one contract.
Okay. And could you define very hard to fill? It's going to be a definition.
To the chair, very hard to fill is defined in regulations currently. It has to do with how long a position has been vacant and how aggressively that position has been recruited for. Employers provide that documentation when they ask for an employee and submit an employee's contract for consideration, that this particular contract we feel is very hard to fill. In regulations now, I believe it's a year that it has been vacant.
You may continue.
So what I'd like to do now is sort of just walk through the process quickly of how this works, how the money flows in and out, to try and give you a little bit better sense of where the state's role is in this particular piece. I'd like to start at the top. First, we have healthcare professionals who work at an eligible site for a calendar quarter. We make payments on a calendar quarter basis, so they have already provided the work for a calendar quarter. At the end of the quarter, the employer, the site, will report on that professional's hours worked to the SHARP program to tell us how much work was actually done. Employees can choose to either be full-time or half-time contracts. And then not all employees work the entire amount of every quarter, and so their payments are adjusted. Then once we have adjusted the payment amount based on the reports that we've received, then the SHARP program will invoice that employer for how much they owe for that particular quarter. And remember, the employee has already worked for that quarter, so they've already done their service for that quarter, and then we bill the employer. The employer will send us, will send the SHARP program a check for the quarterly payment, and that quarterly payment includes the administrative fee that goes along with that contract. Then SHARP will make the payment to the lender if it is a loan repayment, as it doesn't go to the employee if it's a loan. If it's a direct incentive, then yes, it is paid to the employee. Then SHARP provides data back to the advisory council on the positions, on the amount of work, on the type of service that they've been providing, and that helps the advisory council evaluate the program and plan ahead for where the next shortages are, where they're seeing opportunities, and help them to plan for prioritizing contracts moving forward.
Representative Johnston.
Thank you. Through the chair, how you set this up, is there any liability as far as how the billing happens between the employer and the SHARP 3 as far as just cash flow?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, the
The state is not taking on a liability if the employer failed to pay. That is part of the contractual arrangement that we have between the employee, the employer, and ourselves.
Follow up. And I guess my next question is, we'll have to have a system in place so that the employee also doesn't suffer at some point with a cash flow issue. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, that is true. We do need to be mindful of that. I will say that to this point, we have not had difficulties with employers making their payments. I know we're going from a partial match to the full amount, but part of our screening in process for eligibility is to look at their ability to pay and make sure that it seems reasonable that what they have set up is going to sustain the contract.
Thank you.
Representative Tilton. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lewis, with SHARP-1 being starting as a federal program, how many other states out there are kind of following the same path that we're following in trying to create incentives, if you will, within industry to attract healthcare professionals? Are we just like keeping pace with what's going on around the country, or are we kind of more a leader in the field of trying to help groups recruit healthcare professionals?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, Alaska is a little bit on the cutting edge for this. There are many states that participate in the federal program. There are a number of states that have some sort of a state-operated program, and all of them look different because there's, other than to meet the IRS definition of a program, which is very general, they all look a little different. As far as I know, though, we are the first state to come up with this public-private partnership that does not utilize any state general fund to support it, and that it's self-supporting. So in that way, we think we're really being innovative here.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Using on the slide on page 8 as my reference point, looking at Tier 1, let's say a primary health care facility wants to hire a dentist, and the reimbursement is up to $35,000 per year, but the provider could choose to, say, negotiate $20,000 on the repayment, less than the $35,000. Is that a negotiation between the provider and the clinic?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, that's an excellent question. We actually do not allow that kind of negotiation because in order for it to be a state-run program, we can't have arbitrary amounts and arbitrary standards. We need to be consistent in the criteria that we apply. We do have an option. Say you had an employer who wanted to hire someone in Tier 1 and they couldn't quite come up with the whole $35,000. They could decide to go with a half-time contract instead that would be more in keeping with the budget that they have. So they could still participate, but it would be a set amount, so $17,500, if I'm doing math in my head correctly. I know this is the Finance Committee, so I'm challenged here to get that right. But that would be, so if that was more affordable for them, that would be something that they could do. And we encourage them to seek supporting funding. It doesn't all have to come from their own earnings. It can come from philanthropy. It can come from other fundraising. It can come from local government if local government wants to support. So we are agnostic as to where the employer gets the funding from and actually encourage them to get more community involvement in the funding that they have.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the negotiation between the provider and the clinic is a negotiation for salary, benefits, terms and conditions of employment. How do you verify that they're treating that provider under the accordance of this Sharp 3 program, that they're not giving the provider a financial haircut in exchange for $35,000 per year?
Through the chair, Representative Laban, that is one of the duties of our sole employee that runs this program, is to follow up with not just the employers to see how the program is going and how those employees are doing for them, but also to follow up with those employees and make sure the program is working for them as well. We allow for leaves of absence, so if someone is in a particular employment situation and they want to make a change, that we can allow for that. If someone takes a leave of absence, they don't get forgiven for the amount of time. It just pushes their end date out further. So if they take 3 months to find a new employment situation, then their date gets pushed out by 3 months. They still owe us 3 years. So in that way, I think that the employer and employee can still have some negotiation.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
I'm not, maybe we need to take a step back. I'm not sure I understand the whole need for the program. If the healthcare professionals are going to enter into a contract with the eligible site, and then the eligible site reports to the state bills the site pays the state, and then the state pays the lender, why didn't the healthcare site just do all of that themselves? Why involve the state? I'm missing something there.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the only way that the employee can get the tax benefit where that is not considered income on their federal income taxes is the IRS law requires it be a state-run program. So this is a unique situation where the state has a benefit that they can provide to the private sector that they themselves cannot access any other way, but it is voluntary, and employers can decide if that is indeed, you know, worth it to them.
It stretches their dollars further, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. That is the piece that I was missing.
So could the state contract out the entire service? I mean, where they're still in charge, but they say instead of hiring our own employee to do this, could you actually have a third-party service in which the state's still in charge of the program and all the pieces that go with it, but yet we're not necessarily hiring more people, we're going to go with a vendor instead?
Madam Chair, we actually sort of do see it working out that way more or less. There's a minimal amount of staffing that the state would need to have in order to oversee the contract, to manage the program, to do site visits. There are a certain amount of work that the state has to do for it to be a state-run program and be looked at that way. But we're keeping the staffing at the bare minimum that we think we can manage. And we do think that, some parts of the program can be done as well or better by a vendor, which is why we've built that into our plan.
And the reason I ask, because I could just see it being an issue if you have just one employee, and so the employee leaves. Maybe just even maternity leave, they're not leaving for good, versus a service that may have 10 employees, and they're all working on their projects together and not so dependent upon just – and I've seen that happen where we've had programs where that one person has been out for whatever reason, and nobody else is following that program in the same fashion. So I would just be very concerned – if you only had one person doing it and if they left and you had a big gap, you know, how would you fill that gap and not kind of lose the steam that you're on?
Representative, yeah, I guess I would argue that that's just a case for cross-training as well, that, in an office you need to make sure that you have people cross-trained so that somebody can get the flu or take maternity leave or a vacation, which is just a part of doing business on a day-to-day basis for any organization.
You would think so, but I've seen others just have not done that. So, good point. You may continue.
Thank you. So, just to wrap up, HB 114 It's going to keep healthcare professionals in rural communities. It's going to promote health and economic community stability by allowing healthcare to be delivered in the place closest to home and ensure a healthier future for all Alaskans at the very lowest possible cost.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The word rural, is that a real broad definition? And would downtown Fairbanks qualify as rural?
No, but North Pole might.
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, there is no one definition of rural, and particularly not when you're talking about the healthcare industry and what is considered rural. I would say downtown Fairbanks, probably not. That doesn't mean, however, that they wouldn't be doing work with underserved populations or have health shortage areas. So it is not only rural, and actually that has been one of the limitations of the other programs that we have had for SHARP 1 and 2, is such a focus on rural that we have left gaps in the urban areas when the urban areas are that central hub that people go to in order to get more specialty care. And this bill should help that.
Representative LeBron.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the right wordage could be rural or eligible communities. So a primary health care facility in downtown Fairbanks could be eligible for this program.
Representative LeBron, through the chair, that's the reason that we added an underserved to this particular legislation. In SHARP 3 is designed to be, you know, meet the needs of both rural and underserved. So downtown Fairbanks programs will be eligible if they're trying to, if they serve an underserved population. But if you're running an organization that's a for-profit organization operating in downtown, and you may not need this, but if you're running a federally qualified community health center that's providing care to uninsured population, that's an underserved population, and therefore you'd be eligible to participate.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Concerning the tax benefits here, which taxing authority is going to see a decrease in taxes if this program wasn't in place and the people were hired? Are we looking at federal government income taxes?
It's a federal income tax, Representative Carpenter, through the chair. However, I would argue that they probably wouldn't be seeing a reduced tax obligation or tax revenue. They wouldn't be receiving taxes on the loan repayment that otherwise the provider probably wouldn't be getting if it weren't for the SHARP 3 program. So it would be more tax avoidance than it would be reducing taxes to the federal government.
Thank you. And if you ladies would just like to stay there while we have public testimony, just in case there's any questions that come up. Please feel free there. So I'm going to open public testimony on HB 114. And in the room, we have Rachel Gerhardt. You please put yourself on the record and your affiliation. You may begin your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Rachel Gerhardt, and I've been a licensed clinical social worker in Alaska since 2008. And I'm a member of the National Association of Social Workers Alaska chapter. And I serve as the Southeast Region representative to the board. It's through my volunteer NASW service that I also volunteer to sit on the SHARP Council, where NASW Alaska is a voting member and where I serve as the co-chair. I'm also a constituent of Representative Sarah Hannon's District 33, which is not considered a federally designated geographic health professional shortage area. And unless you work for the tribal health organization in town, you're not eligible for student loan repayment, either through SHARP 1 or National Health Service Corps. Yet I definitely work with an underserved population, even in Juneau. And I wanted to point it out, the slide that had the percentages of locations, and I'm sorry, I forgot who pointed out why, I think it was you, Representative Wilson, why Interior and North might be a lower percentage. Some of that may be that some geographic areas have a higher percentage of HPSAs, which means agencies within that would be eligible for SHARP 1 or for National Health Service Corps. That could be. That's just a guess. So speaking of HPSAs, I do my research when I do this. So co-chair Wilson's district, yours is not a HPSA. Neither are the districts that Representative Johnston, Josephson, Laban, or Merrick represent. Representative Ortiz, Tilton, Sullivan, Leonard, Knopp, and Carpenter, your districts are considered geographic HPSAs for mental health only. And Upper Mat-Su, though, is approved for primary care and for dental. Of the representatives on this committee, only co-chair Foster, your whole district qualifies as a HPSA for primary care, dental, and for mental health. So I want to thank Representative Johnston for signing on as a co-sponsor, meaning that I understand that you understand the value to both rural and urban underserved areas and residents in your district. So we have dabbled in this arena before with Sharp 2, and it's time that we take no additional state expenditures, and it's time that we sign on for good. So I was one of those lucky 83 recipients of Sharp 2, and after paying on my student loans for 7 years already, so I was not a recruited person, I had already been recruited, and after a 3-year Sharp 2 fee for service as a very hard to fill position, I'm now student debt free 20 years early, and I still work at the same agency where I have worked almost 9 years, and I have lived in Alaska nearly 13 years. So retention matters. So while we in this room cannot designate all of Alaska as a HPSA, we can use Sharp 3 to recruit and retain quality staff to serve our vulnerable and underserved Alaskans. We can help well-trained, compassionate health professionals turn from chuchaco to sourdough. As the Finance Committee, you may be interested to know that we get a fair amount of data from those quarterly work reports that are completed by participants in the Sharp program. We're able to track who works in primarily substance use capacities and which positions are full-time permanent positions that replace what was once a costly locum tenens position. We learn important demographics about who stays at their employer and who may not stay in the employer, but who stays in their community and who stays in the state, so that we can further make recruitment and retention efforts in Alaska's health professionals that are targeted. According to a study by the National Healthcare Retention and RN Staffing Report, since 2013, the average hospital has turned over 85.2% of its workforce. The average cost of turnover across all occupations in the healthcare industry is $60,000. And some reports estimate that replacing one physician as costing at least $200,000 and as high as $1 million. And those two statistics are not Alaskan specific. And I think that we can all agree that Alaskan hospitals and healthcare providers are anything but average. In Alaska, there was a study done in 1998 of developmental disability service providers who contracted with the state. There were 28 providers and 23 responded. And they were asked about how much they spent on advertising, overtime, recruitment costs like fingerprinting, background checks, and training. And at that time, which was more than 20 years ago, per worker they spent $2,341. So healthcare is a growing field, and it was someone over here, I think it was Representative Sullivan Leonard, you asked which professions, and I know most about social work as a social worker, and we are the largest group of mental health care providers in the United States. And social work employment is projected to grow 16% by 2026, faster than the average for all other occupations. It's important to note that Sharp 3 will not only expand eligible sites, but will expand eligible professions, and I know you've heard some of those before. Occupational therapists, art therapists, case managers, CNAs, training coordinators, chemical dependency counselors, dental hygienists, healthcare faculty members, phlebotomists, and peer recovery coaches are some more examples of included professionals working in healthcare settings that can be included if they have qualified student loans and are working at eligible sites. In my line of work, the therapeutic alliance that you have with your client is considered the most important factor in how well you'll work together. It's not your age, it's not your gender, it's not where you were born, or whether you have kids. Once clients in primary care, dental care, and health care with high ACEs scores and years of trauma, and often comorbid conditions with co-occurring disorders start to connect, that's when we see progress. Disruptions in service delivery because of staff turnover that may be due to high cost of living is unavoidable. Sharp 3 Support for Service helps all Alaskans live their own best lives. So as a provider, a SHARP alum, and SHARP Council co-chair, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Foster.
Thank you very much for your testimony there. You had mentioned that my entire district was eligible, but then you had also referenced the page that showed that Interior and Northern is only 3%, and I assume Nome is in that category. And I was just curious if we're eligible, why the numbers are so low. And you had explained that earlier, but I just didn't quite understand.
Sure. Co-Chair Foster, what I was referencing is that that's SHARP 2 numbers. And so SHARP 2 expanded on SHARP 1. SHARP 1 is limited to a geographic HPSA. Your whole area would be eligible for SHARP 1 or National Health Service Corps, whereas much of the rest of the state and many representatives on the Finance Committee's constituents would not be eligible. And so my guess, and it's just a guess, is that there may be a low percentage in Interior and Northern who applied for SHARP 2 because much of your district is eligible for SHARP 1. So many you may have people who applied for SHARP 1 or other student loan repayment programs that they were eligible for because, as Jill mentioned, you can only apply for one at a time.
And yes. Ms. Lewis, would you have the list of who has applied and received assistance through the SHARP 1 group?
Madam Chair, I don't have the list with me, but we can certainly get you the list of employers who have participated.
I'd appreciate that. I think that might give us a better understanding whether or not they don't know about the program or they just, you know, have other ways of being able to fill these hard positions. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as a follow-up to that question, for example, downtown Fairbanks is not real rural. I think it's a little bit rural. But talking about Interior Community Health Center, it has participated in SHARP 1 and 2, I believe.
Through the chair, I believe that is correct.
And if I could follow up. If they have participated in SHARP 1 and 2, is it very likely they're eligible to participate in SHARP 3?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, it is certain that they would be eligible to participate. SHARP 1 is the most restrictive. SHARP 2 is less restrictive. SHARP 3 is even less restrictive. So each one has expanded on the other. This will be the most open-ended program that we have to date.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions for Ms. Gerhardt? Okay, we also have online John Zanata. If you could please put yourself on the record, you may testify. You might want to make sure you're not on mute.
Sorry about that.
It's usually the problem.
Can you hear me now?
We can. Please put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. My name is John Tezada, and I am the policy director for the Alaska Primary Care Association. We support the operations and development of Alaska's 27 community health center organizations. Together with the leaders of our community health centers, we strongly support this bill and the SHARP 3 program. We have three particular points on how this legislation will help health centers better serve Alaskans. Number one, as everyone has been talking about in this hearing today, there is a shortage of health professionals of all types in Alaska. This is the number one leading operating concern of health centers in the state. Health center leaders can constantly grapple with vacant healthcare clinical positions in their clinics. Although healthcare jobs remain the fastest growing sector in the state labor economy, the demands are outpacing the availability. What we're seeing in health centers is that Alaskans are growing older, needing more health care. There's an increased incidence of chronic disease, and this requires more constant care and more health care professionals that are not evenly distributed across the state. Number two, SHARP and other loan repayment programs have been absolutely critical for community health centers. Since its inception in 2010, the SHARP 1 program issued 172 contracts to health centers, and SHARP 2 issued 47 contracts with health center providers. 140 of those were medical, 43 dental, and 36 behavioral health. SHARP has been able also to address some of the disparity in distribution of the providers, placing them from Anchorage to Juneau to Norton Sound, the YK, the Kenai, and out to the Dutch Harbor. And finally, we believe as a SHARP council member that SHARP 3 is a creative solution to replace the federally or the state-funded SHARP 2 program with a privately funded option. SHARP 3 will offer a valuable state infrastructure without any additional state general funds and will provide the ability to expand the benefits of SHARP to areas that are not health professional shortage areas, which is a requirement of SHARP 1. And it will help expand the provider types that are eligible for loan payment. Alaska's health centers are prepared to utilize SHARP 3 as soon as it's available, and we're eager to continue the momentum of SHARP to support the workforce development of health centers in Alaska. And I thank you for your time.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for being online for us today. Are there any others online? Anyone else in the room that would like to testify? So I'm going to close testimony on HB 114. Again, we're going to set this bill aside. The companion bill should be with us very soon. And we will see, hopefully come back to us this week. Are there any other questions to come before us or concerns? I will see everybody back here at 4 o'clock as we continue our journey down SB 91 to HB 54 and others. This meeting is adjourned at 3:06.
Point of order, Madam Chair.
Call the meeting to order. I call House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday. Still, we're at 4 o'clock. We had began on Thursday speaking on criminal justice review, starting with SB 91 and working through HB 54 and HB 138 and how all those go together as we are anticipating a crime bill coming our way and what issues that we may still need to fix and some that may need a little bit more data coming to us to seeing whether or not those programs that we put together are finally showing, that reaping the rewards we had hoped for. And with that, we're going to have Ms. Mead come up. And Ms. Winkleman, don't want to leave you out. And we're going to have Ms. Mead just finish up on, so that she doesn't have to stay up there the whole time. Then we'll go back in and take care of our criminal, as he went to jail last time we had heard. So on the parole probation, the court does still play a part in the parole probation period. And Ms. Mead's just going to go through what part the judges still do as far as ordering programs or conditions upon release. Ms. Mead.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. The other day, I basically finished going through pretrial and sentencing pieces of our criminal justice system and some of the other big changes, as the chair stated, left to talk about in terms of criminal justice is the probation and parole program. Some people get those mixed up, what is probation and what is parole. Very briefly, the court orders a probationary term, and parole, in contrast, is 100% handled by the Department of Corrections. So a person can be simultaneously on probation and parole. If they violate terms of probation, they come back to the court. If they violate terms of parole, they go back to DOC. The court has zero to do with parole. But we do have something to do with probation. So very often with criminal sentences, the person might be sentenced to 10 years with a certain 3 years suspended, for example. And in addition to your term of imprisonment, the court can order terms of probation, and usually does. Those maximums were changed with SB 91, but generally the law right now is that for a felony sex offense, the maximum is 15 years. An unclassified felony, the maximum is 10 years, other felonies, 5 years. There are other sort of specific things for 1141s, which are crimes against a person, typically assaults and things like that. For domestic violence, for sex crimes that are misdemeanors, the maximum's 3 years, second DUI, 2 years, and other misdemeanors, 1 year. Also, there are minimums for sex felonies. Unclassifieds are 15 years, A or B felony sex crimes are 10 years, and C is 5 years. So those are set in statute. They're just not movable, so the court has some discretion within there to order certain terms of probationary terms. During the probationary term, the law allows certain ways for a person to get off probation earlier than the court ordered. Some of those are the subject of some of the governor's crime bills to adjust those. But right now, the probation officer recommends a termination of probation for somebody who's in compliance with, all their conditions after set time periods as well. Those set time periods were adjusted in SB 54 to different time periods. But in essence, right now, the probation officer does recommend a termination of probation after 2 years for A, B, felonies, and 1 year for C and others. This does not apply to unclassified offenses, sex offenses, or DV offenses. And SB 54 changed the 1 year to 18 months. So there is a way, if somebody is complying with everything they're supposed to be doing, to get off probation early. And in addition, SB 91 added credits during your period of probation, so that for each month that a person does well, they get could get a month shortened off the end of their time period. So as you can see from the math, a person could have their probationary term cut in half if they are in compliance with all their probationary conditions. There are a number of conditions the court can impose for probation, and our typical judgment has a whole list of them. Some are pre-checked, as in always going to be imposed. For example, must obey all federal, state, and local laws. Others the judge can consider depending on the crime for which the person is being sentenced.
One of the most common ones is to comply with the things that your probation officer tells you to do. And another very common one is to be assessed for treatment needs and then to follow the program recommended by whoever does the assessing. So the court doesn't have the information or expertise to say you need inpatient treatment for 2 years, but what they do say is you need to be assessed and then follow the recommendation of that assessor, and that's very commonly done. The one exception is sex offender treatment. The probation statute says for certain sex offenses, the person must have as a condition to go to a sex offender treatment program. That's about the extent of what I know about those programs, but they are mandatory for certain offenses. And I think that's almost all I have to say about probation, unless there are questions.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, Madam Chair, it may help to clarify that, because I have to keep this clear in my mind, but if a sentence, for example, is 6 years with three suspended, that means 3 years to serve and 3 years of suspended time. So if someone said, well, what's the period of probation? You might say, well, there's 3 years of probation. But that's different than the period of probation during which time those 3 years could be imposed. So I'm just letting folks know about that.
Is that 3 years of probation or 3 years of parole?
Through the chair, the time period that a person gets released early for good time credit, which is statutory and nearly everyone gets it unless they misbehave in a pretty serious way in the institution, that's called mandatory parole. So they are released, for example, if you have a 9-year sentence, typically and not always, good time credit under statute means that you will be released at 6 years. That remaining 3 years, you are on mandatory parole. Simultaneously, during that 3-year period, you're on probation as well, and your probationary term will have started. And so if you have a transgression, you could be brought to the court for under a petition to revoke probation, and or brought to the parole board and for a petition to revoke parole. So the court handles the probationary ones, and as Representative Josephson said, can then impose on the person that suspended time, which is literally hanging over your head, and you can go back in for those transgressions because you violated your conditions of release. With some exceptions, with SB 91, the legislature, you, added what's called technical violations of probation. So if the violation is not a new crime or failure to go to your betters program or failure to go to sex treatment, it's technical, and the first several times that you do get a petition to revoke probation, the time that you can spend, the time that the judge can impose then is capped at 3, 5, and 10 days. The fourth time and forward, you can get all your suspended time imposed, and you can go to jail for that time period.
Do we have any idea how many are sitting currently under probation, parole, technical violations?
Through the chair, I don't know, but they're quite common, and maybe the Department of Corrections has that answer.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I'm the Director of Probation and Parole and Pretrial, and I'm guessing on any given day we could get the number of folks that are serving time on technical violations, but I don't have that today.
Okay, if we could get that so we know what the percentage, I'd appreciate it. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Ms. Mead, I think I'm right about my thinking, but maybe not. So when we say someone is on or received mandatory parole, that's not really a thing the parole board deals with, per se. It just means they were released after 2/3 of their time, right? In other words, there's no event to follow from that. It just means they did 6 of 9 years, or they did 4 of 6 years.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that is my understanding, but I really do try not to answer questions about parole since it is not the court's bailiwick.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand correctly that with probation, somebody gets picked up with a probation violation, it isn't until their fourth probation violation that the courts would then consider imposing their maximum sentence again. Could you go back and repeat that?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, SB 91 added a statute about technical violations of probation. So, for example, if the person doesn't show up for an appointment or has a dirty urinalysis test or drug test or something like that, that's considered under the statute to be technical. So the first time that happens, when the probation officer comes to court and files a PTRP, petition to revoke the probation, the statute limits the judge's ability to impose time beyond 3 days. The second time he or she can impose 5 days for one of those technical violations, the third time 10. Thereafter, any of the suspended time can be imposed. But that doesn't count if the petition to revoke probation is based on a new crime that is not technical or not going to your betters treatment or sex offense treatment. Those are not technical, and the first time the court could impose whatever of your suspended time for those.
Thank you. Josephson.
So through the chair, Ms. Mead, my memory of this is what would happen when I was involved was if there were, for example, 2 years of